listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
Well, we've had a lot since the last time we spoke, of course. It's a very busy region, and I think maybe the hot points that we could begin talking about, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Peru.
Yeah, and before we start on that, and it's probably quite useful to let our listeners know that how things are going on in places like Mexico and Argentina. In Mexico, López Obrador, the incoming president now, he's beginning to implement his program, and we're beginning to see what the configuration of political forces is in Mexico. And at the moment, it looks as though he's maintaining his popularity, trying to implement the program that he promised, and there's the first signs of some pushback from the right-wing interests that dominate Mexico's elite, of course. And then in Argentina, there's the deepening crisis there that you and I spoke about. We that is so predictable, wasn't it? What's happened in Argentina? Yeah. There's a deepening economic crisis. And the use of the abuse, or rather the abuse of the government's political power in the judicial system to attack progressive politicians like former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and others. And then in Brazil, of course, it's so predictable what's going to happen in Brazil. Jair Bolsonaro, the new extreme right wing, some would say fascist, I would say fascist, president, is implementing his already implementing his attack on working people, on pensions, on social security, on indigenous people, on the environment. And so that's going to end in a very predictable disaster for Brazil very, very soon, within a year, I'd say.
That comes on the heels of those policies, a lot of them coming in already. You had Temer implemented the austerity stuff again, the right-wing economics, and so then you have a predictable response from the people, and it looks like rather than trying to let that vent and some back and forth, that they're going to try to go hardcore. And I don't know if that's going to be the model for Argentina also, when as people push back there, but it's not a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign. One of the reasons I wanted to talk especially about Peru this morning is because, in contrast to that very predictable catastrophe in social and economic terms that's taking place in Argentina and Brazil, in Peru you have the possibility, at the moment it's only a possibility, of a successful right-wing model that doesn't involve that kind of repression and the kind of corruption of political processes, democratic political processes, that we've seen in Brazil and Argentina. There, in Peru, the current president, Vizcarra, he came to power following the resignation of former President Kuczynski, who had to leave office, give up the presidency under a cloud of corruption allegations, and his very, very unpopular pardon for the former dictator in Peru, Alberto Fujimori. Now, what Vizcarra did, he's very much pushing the anti-corruption motif in Peruvian politics. And as part of that campaign to try and rebuild the credibility and prestige of the executive power, it's very interesting, because I'm not an expert on Peru, it's difficult to say how genuine all this is. But it looks as though he really is trying to attack the effectively two-party system that dominated Peru for many, many years, between the supporters of Alberto Fujimori and his family, and the other leading power bloc, the APRE bloc, which is strongly associated with the extremely corrupt figure of Alan Garcia in Peru. Now, how genuine Vizcarra's efforts are to combat that kind of those two very powerful interest blocks, political and economic interest blocks in Peru, how genuine his efforts are to combat that, it's impossible for me to say, because I just don't know. But he organized what turned out to be a very successful referendum. I think it was at the beginning of December last year, or late November, which approved the questions in the popular referendum were whether there should be reform of the system whereby judges are selected, whether there should be stricter financial regulation of political parties, whether there should be a second chamber in the Peruvian legislature, and whether legislators should be allowed to run for re-election. And he got what he wanted on all of those. So there's going to be reform of the way judges are picked. There's going to be stronger financial regulation of the political parties. There's going to be no re-election of members to the legislature once they've finished their first period. And there's going to be, there's not going to be a second chamber in the Peruvian legislature.
That went down. It was 3 out of 4 that went forward.
Right. So that's a blow to what the very strong political and economic interests supporting Alberto Fujimori and his family, Fujimori's daughter Keiko, is I think she's currently in jail on she was sentenced to preventive prison, in the course of proceedings to do with corruption charges. And the other leading bloc, the APRE bloc, Alan Garcia, their leading politician, their best known politician, he actually sought refuge, I think it was in the Uruguayan embassy, because he was afraid that he'd be indicted and put in jail for also on corruption charges. So what does that mean in terms of stepping back, looking at the region as a whole? What does that, what do all those goings on in Peru mean? What they mean is that President Vizcarra is using the anti-corruption motif to successfully try and open up, apparently, chances for constitutional reform to meet social demands. Now, he's doing that from a right-wing perspective.
Yeah, not just successfully. Let me just interrupt one thing here. You have almost 25 million registered voters in Peru, and 17,500, or about 73%, turned out, which is a substantial turnout. On the first three questions that were approved, it was 86% approved against, 13-14%. And on the fourth question, which was rejected, it was almost the exact opposite. It was 9 and change and 90%. So you have huge chunks of the population that, are taking this particular position and expressing it at the ballot box.
Yeah, and it's hard to say whether Vizcarra is just riding that current road of deep resentment among the Peruvian population against the political system and against the judicial system, genuinely, in order to open up genuine constitutional reform that might, in theory, open up Peru's democracy, which has been dominated, as we were saying earlier, by those two extremely corrupt blocks around Alberto Fujimori's supporters and the APRE supporters.
Yeah, be the president, go to jail, be the president, go to jail. That's kind of how it's been the last few presidents now.
Yeah, absolutely, over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And yep. So the Frente Amplio, the left-wing force in Peru, has failed to capitalize on that. And you'd think that they'd be able to capitalize on that if they were really in touch with the popular mood. But in fact, it's been President Vizcarra, who appears at least, to have taken the initiative. And that may be an interesting precedent in terms of how the right wing does politics in Latin America, in contrast to the absolutely failed model of Argentina and Brazil under their current right wing governments. So anyway, and I just thought that it was interesting to mention that to our listeners, so that they have an idea of, that although the right wing has very little to offer in terms of political options and economic policies and social policies in Brazil and Argentina, you have this very interesting development in Peru, which is fundamentally quite a conservative country. Despite having a very strong socialist tradition, that tradition is very much a minority tradition in Peru. So we should keep an eye on that over the next few months. We should keep an eye on that over the next few months, Tom, to see how that right wing, that possible right wing, or viable right wing alternative to progressive socialist inspired policies actually develops. So then switching from Peru to Venezuela, and the very big event last week, of course, was the presidential inauguration of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And he took office under extremely controversial circumstances in regional terms, because although he is very, his legitimacy as a democratically elected president is beyond question, beyond any doubt. But of course, the role of the right wing in the region has been for years to question the democratic credentials of the Venezuelan government. And it's so ironic that you get governments like the government of Mauricio Macri in Argentina, the government of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, leading the charge against Venezuela on the grounds that the government there is not democratic. You just have to look at events in Brazil and Argentina to realize how absurd and paradoxical and ironic that is. And also, of course, you have the expression of the regional offensive, obviously guided by the United States authorities against Venezuela, has been the so-called group Lima Group, a group of about 12 countries, including Canada. Originally it included Mexico, but Mexico refused to ratify the declaration that the Lima Group made against Venezuela immediately prior to the election, and subsequently to the election too. So the Lima Group consists of all the right-wing countries in South America, and I think Costa Rica and Panama are also members of the Lima Group, and I think also surprisingly the Caribbean island of Santa Lucia. I might be wrong about that, but what they said prior to the election was that they wouldn't recognize President Nicolas Maduro is the legitimate president of Venezuela, and subsequently they ratified that rejection after the inauguration. But it happened under very strange circumstances, because just a few days, and I think a week or 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, prior to President Maduro's inauguration on January the 10th, there was an incident, a very provocative incident, in which a US company, I'm not sure, I think it might have been Exxon, they sent an oil exploration vessel into Venezuelan territorial waters, ostensibly trying to push their luck to see if they could try and explore for oil in maritime territory that Guyana claims. Guyana is Venezuela's neighbor to the south. There's a territorial dispute over an area called the Essequibo, dating back to the 19th century. Incredible stuff from, you know, colonial leftovers.
Yeah.
So part of that dispute involves maritime waters as well. But the waters in which the U.S. company oil exploration vessel tried to drill were definitely Venezuelan waters. And what the Lima Group did in their declaration prior to President Maduro's inauguration was to claim that Venezuela had violated Guyana's territorial rights by a government impounds a vessel? The Venezuelan authorities impounded that oil exploration vessel and subsequently escorted it out of Venezuela.
That's one term that's used, is to impound or to impress it. Yeah.
Right. So, and subsequently, even the Guyanan government had to admit that, because they originally claimed that the Venezuelan Navy boarded the oil exploration vessel and took it over, and that's not true. And they also claiming that the incident happened in Guyanan waters, and that's not true. And subsequently, following President Maduro's inauguration, the new administration's foreign minister, Jorge Arreaza, wrote a letter to all the 12 members of the Lima Group demanding that they correct their false claim that about Venezuela's territorial limits, because that would have involved an extremely serious, even more serious than the mess already is around recognizing Venezuela. If they'd actually refused to recognize Venezuela's borders, that would have been an extremely serious violation of international law. Now, of the 12 Lima Group members, 10 of them rectified their position and acknowledged that Venezuela had not impounded the vehicle in Guyanan waters, and that the incident happened in Venezuelan territorial waters. Now, that might all sound very arcane to people listening, but It's actually very important because the way the United States government works and the way the current extreme right-wing offensive against Venezuela works is that they chip away at every little thing. Every little detail counts. So that in the attempt to weaken Venezuela, the authority of Venezuela, Venezuela's government, of Venezuela's authorities, of Venezuela's armed forces, of its legitimate right to its actual physical territory, and they're trying every kind of maneuver, and that's to try and weaken that.
Yeah.
And that's what the attempt by the Exxon oil exploration vessel was all about. So now, what's happened in regional terms, stepping back and looking at it from a continental point of view, is that now the U.S. Guided a regional offensive by all these right-wing countries has failed. It continues to fail. They've been trying to overthrow President Maduro since 2013, ever since he took, he won the presidential election that year following the death of Eternal Comandante Hugo Chavez. And ever since then, what are we talking about now? 6 years?
Yeah, 6 years.
Almost every day, they've tried something.
Some new thing. Yeah, you know, and they've cranked it up since Bolton came into office again. There's been another push there and in the Congress with the with the boycott and sanctioned legislation. While you've been speaking, I went to look at the current version of the Wikipedia description of the inauguration of Maduro, and it looks like it was written not just by the CIA, but like by the most rabid, insane person in the CIA. And you can see, though, in the midst of that, some fact pattern that shows, this really hardcore attempt to force regime change there. At the time of the inauguration, they set off the few bombs that they have. You have a move at the OAS declaring that this is an illegitimate election. The same with the Lima Group, which is the, the TPP group, basically. You have a guy from the Electoral Commission who defects on January 7th, Zerpa, who, they leave out the fact that he was about to be charged for sexual harassment. But he leaves, he's defecting. And then they talk about in this, for example, the turnout was only 25% for the presidential election. Showed up for the ceremony for the inauguration, and they don't quantify that. And then they talk about how Juan Guaido, who is the president of the National Assembly, in other words, the head of the group that is organized, where the opposition is organized, the U.S.-backed opposition is organized, he calls for a protest. And they were able to block off one street. There was like almost no support for
There's lots to say about the inauguration and the event around it.
Yeah.
And what I was gonna say was that.
Yeah. Sorry.
Despite those 6 years of constant that's right, and that's all very useful information and typical of Wikipedia, of course. But What I was going to say was that after 6 years of daily attempts to overthrow the government, and the Venezuelan authorities have resisted everything, and they've overcome everything.
That's right.
And so the things aren't great in Venezuela, but they wouldn't be after 6 years of economic sanctions and financial blockade and every kind of attempt to disrupt ordinary social and political life. And despite all that, the Venezuelan government continues to implement its social housing program. What was it, the 2 million, just last December,
that's right.
Was their 2 millionth house that they'd provided to people.
Yep.
on low incomes.
Yeah, that second million, that second million since Hugo Chavez passed. So that's, you know, that is the second million housing unit is, you know, entirely from Maduro's administration, while they've suffered this economic warfare, like, massively.
Yeah, and they've reduced extreme poverty to 4.4%. Those are UN figures.
Yep.
And their Gini index, which I mean, a lot of people question as the reliability of the Gini index as a measure of inequality. But I mean, for what it's worth, the Gini index, they've got that down to 0.38, which is one of the lowest in the region, if not the lowest. And so despite all those 6 years of constant assault on the Venezuelan government's efforts to resolve economic problems, resolve social problems, they have indeed continued to make gains and achievements, especially in terms of poverty reduction, in terms of reducing inequality. So on those domestic criteria, the Venezuelan government has completely defeated the attempts by the United States and its regional allies to sabotage their efforts to improve life in Venezuela. They haven't been able to make all the improvements that they want, but the underlying trends are still there: reduction in poverty and reduction in inequality. And so the other thing that's worth bearing in mind about President Maduro's inauguration is that, whereas in regional terms he suffered the rejection of the United States and its allies, in global terms he has the recognition of Russia, China, Mexico, Turkey, all the ALBA countries, most of the African countries, and I think it's a total of 110 countries that have formally recognized the new administration. So, you know, it's like the United States and its allies are claiming that Venezuela's isolated, but they're the ones that are isolated. In particular, the United States is isolated in diplomatic terms internationally. And that was very much reflected in the presidential inauguration of Nicolas Maduro. So then, looking at that, you'd think, well, the situation of Venezuela is hopeless, because I think that, you know, that's the impression that the United States and its corporate media and the regional media tried to give. But in fact, it's the position of the United States and its allies that is weakening progressively and progressively faster. For example, if you look at the situation in Guyana, which is Venezuela's neighbor, which the United States has tried to use as a kind of stalking horse to further weaken the ability of Venezuela to demonstrate its sovereignty, because Venezuela and Guyana are involved in this conflict over that territory that we mentioned earlier, the Essequibo. But it's the Guyanan government that's in crisis, not the Venezuelan government. David Granger, the Prime Minister of Guyana, because it's a parliamentary system there, he's actually, I think he's suffering from cancer and occasionally has to go on for medical treatment in the United States. But he lost a confidence vote to the Guyanan opposition, who are very much against Granger's policy of appeasing the United States and antagonizing their neighbor Venezuela. The opposition leader, a guy called Barat Jagdeo, he promoted that confidence vote, which his opposition won. And now, under the Constitution, Granger's government should resign and call new elections. Now, they had a meeting last week, I think it was on Friday, a very inconclusive meeting, and all the signs point to what may turn out to be a quite a prolonged crisis in Guyana. The government's mounted a legal challenge to the legislature, the vote in the legislature. I'm not sure how that works, but it seems quite strange that the legislature should be subject to a legal challenge in the courts.
Right.
But, you know, and that's what's going on there. And so in terms of Guyana, its government is in crisis, whereas the Venezuelan government is going from strength to strength. And today, it's either today or tomorrow, I think, President Maduro is presenting his government's program in the Constituent Assembly in Venezuela, because it's also worth pointing out that he was inaugurated in the Supreme Court in Venezuela because the opposition-dominated legislature continues to act illegally by refusing to acknowledge the judgment of the Supreme Court and the electoral power, ordering them to annul three deputies that they've insisted on maintaining in the legislature, despite the fact that they legally they have no right to be there.
This is since the last election, and in addition to that, the legislature refused to perform its constitutional function at the instruction of the electoral authorities and the court over this last election. And instead, you have the president of the legislature in front of the OAS securing a declaration from the OAS, from Milagro, saying that he's the president of Venezuela, which is about as ridiculous as it gets. We're out of time.
Yeah.
We didn't even get to cover Nicaragua and the OAS, and I want to get to that sometime this week because that's the other big story down there. I mean, there's so many things going on right now, but we definitely want to cover that, particularly after speaking with the foreign minister last week. So I'd like to thank you for your time, as always, and let's try to hook up midweek, late this week, okay, Tom?
Okay, look forward to it, Tom. Thanks a million.
Thank you, too. We appreciate it. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the first edition of Worlds Apart in 2019. Happy holidays and thank you for keeping us by your side this year. An old adage has it that councils of war never fight, meaning that decision makers often get caught up in deliberations rather than actually making and implementing decisions. That may not be so bad in the case of war, but what about peace? Do councils of peace or the UN peacekeeping operations deliver what they set out to do? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Severin Ottoser, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University, and the scholar of peacekeeping. Professor Ottoser, it's a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor, let me start with a personal question. I know you spent years studying African conflicts, which happen to be some of the deadliest conflicts on this planet, and you studied them primarily through field work rather than social media, which seems to be the custom these days. What made you so attracted to this inherently dangerous subject?
Well, it's an inherently dangerous subject, but it's also fascinating. And the impact that research can have, if we can get things right, if we can understand how to build peace, what works in building peace, that can impact the lives of millions of people. So to me, it's really worth it.
If I were a man, it may sound like a sexist question, but as a woman who worked in conflict zones, I think I can ask you that. Violence and sexual violence is prevalent in most conflict zones, and I assume Africa is no exception. Did you, as a Western scholar, as a young, attractive woman, run the same risks as some of the people whose experiences you were studying?
Well, I think that no matter who you are, once you end up in a conflict zone, there is a likelihood that you're going to end up at the wrong place at the wrong time. And then, for example, it's happened to me several times that I was in a place that was considered safe, and then rebel groups started bombing the city, and one of the bombs actually fell in my garden. So that's the kind of thing that no matter who you are, what you look like, no matter your gender, you're going to face if you work in conflict zones. Now, being a woman that has a lot of additional risk and a lot of additional disadvantages, but also it brings a lot of opportunities because other women talk to you much more openly. So it gives you a different perspective.
Have you ever found yourself in a situation in the field when you genuinely feared for your life and safety, when you thought that you may not live another day?
Yes, I have several times. But every time I was very, very fortunate because I had friends on the ground who took me in, sheltered me, and then helped me escape the city. And this is something that I'm so incredibly fortunate because I'm a foreigner. No matter where I go, I have a passport that enables me to come out, to go out. While people who live in conflict zone, Congolese people, Palestinian people, Timorese people, they don't have this luxury.
Well, the reason I'm asking all these questions is because in both of your books, Peaceland and The Trouble with Congo, you're very critical of the expatriates' tendency to live in a bubble, driving around in white SUVs, living behind big walls, frequenting expat bars. What do you think is driving this tendency? What's behind it?
Well, there are many things that are driving this tendency. I think the first one is that when peacekeepers or foreign peace builders are hired to go on the ground and build peace in a country, they're sent to a country that they usually don't know a lot about, and very often they don't speak the local languages. And when they arrive, they're there for 6 months, a year, 2 years. So imagine you arrive somewhere, you don't speak the language, you don't understand the culture, you don't have any contact, and you know that you're there only for a short period of time. That's going to put you in a mindset where you think, okay, it's better for me to associate with other foreigners than to associate with local people. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, there are a lot of negative prejudice and negative opinions of local people that are vehiculated among international peace builders. So the whole thing combines to creating this bubble that you were talking about.
Well, I've actually also witnessed that self-imposed isolation with the UN observers in Syria. And it was driven, in my opinion, not by any arrogance or bias, but simply by security considerations. And when I put that question to the former head of the UN peacekeeping operations, he told me exactly that there were protocols for that, and that limiting exposure to the locals was deemed as one of the precautions. He said that if you send people in harm's way, you ought to give them that. Do you disagree with that?
Yes, I do. So what you say is the kind of thing that I hear all the time when I talk to peacekeepers or peace builders, and they always tell me, oh, it's because of security issues. The thing is that when you go to places like Timor-Leste or Jerusalem or places like that where you have very little security issues, or even Cyprus, where the security conditions are really good, you still see the same kind of tendency to live in a bubble. So to me, there is much more at play than just security concerns.
But in addition to security and safety, I think there is also an issue of neutrality at play here. If the peacekeepers are seen hanging out in local rather than expat bars, don't you think that that may create a perception of bias depending on who they are hanging out with?
Well, it could, of course, but consider what is the what are the drawbacks of not hanging out in local bars, not hanging out with people, not talking to them. It means that they basically don't know what's going on around them. So we're sending people to conflict zones. We're telling them try to build peace in this place, but we don't give them any opportunity to actually do their job because they don't have the knowledge going in that they need, the knowledge of local conditions, local cultures, etc. And on top of that, we're telling them stay in your bunker and don't interact with local people. So they can't actually develop the knowledge that they need, the knowledge of local conditions, the understanding of why people are fighting and what it would take to build peace. And on top of that, it's not as if staying, removed from local local people was a way to guarantee that peacekeepers are viewed as neutral and objective. Because you've seen that in Syria, I'm mm-hmm. sure, and in Libya and in Afghanistan. I've seen that in all of the places where I've worked. Local people always complained that the international peace builders are biased, that mm-hmm. they are biased in favor of their enemies. Mm-hmm. So the current strategy is not guaranteeing any kind of perception of neutrality or objectivity. And on top of that, it's making peace building much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Now, in both of your books, you were critical of not only how the UN personnel socialize, but also how they go about their work. And you specifically argue that the current top-down approach to conflict resolution, when the UN intervenes, when it tries to mediate between the leaders of the warring parties, is both ineffective and wasteful. How do you think it could be changed?
It could be changed by complementing it with bottom-up strategy. So what I mean is that currently the way we build peace is that we try to interact with elite. We try to reconcile governments, rebel leaders, presidents. We get them around the table and we try to have them sign peace agreements. And as we've seen in Syria, in Afghanistan, in South Sudan, virtually everywhere, these kind of piece of paper, they don't really work. Mm-hmm. They don't actually build peace on the ground. So what mm-hmm. we need is to start building peace from the grassroots. Mm-hmm. We need to complement the elite center strategies with strategies that are centered on ordinary people and local leaders, and that in my research I've shown are actually working.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree with you in a sense that when we look at the goals of many UN peacekeeping operations, they're termed in a very general, very abstract language. Confidence building, power sharing, strengthening the rule of law, etc. But we all know that the devil is always in the detail. What does it take to operationalize what would work best in the Congolese context as opposed to, let's say, the Syrian context? I assume it's always different, isn't it?
Yes, it's always different. So I think that giving you an example would be the best way to answer your question. There is an island in Congo that's called Ijwi. It's right at the border between Congo and Rwanda. So it's in the most violent area of Congo. And it has everything, all of the conditions that have led to violence in other parts of Congo. Knowing that Congo is the stage of the deadliest conflict since World War II, between 2 and 5 million people have died there. So Ijwi has the same preconditions that you find around it. You find land conflict, you find extreme poverty, ethnic tension, geostrategic location, everything. But in the island, people have managed to build peace and to maintain peace for close to 15 years by using local leaders, ordinary people, bottom-up grassroots strategies.
I think in this kind of situation, it would be very tempting for the United Nations to look at this very successful example and try to apply it to other conflicts. And you actually were also critical of that because you believe that this cookie-cutter approach isn't working well. And my question to you is whether this standardized approach to conflict resolution isn't really the direct consequence of the UN's own organizational structure. And can you introduce those changes on the micro level without changing this very big bureaucracy first?
Yes, you do need to change the bureaucracy. I completely agree with you. There needs to be a huge reform of United Nations peacekeeping so that first the people we send to the ground are people who know about the countries and the situations in which they're going to work so that then they can support local people. And also we need to change the mindset of the peacekeeping operations and the outside peace builders so that they don't arrive with this idea that as outsiders, we know what the solutions are. We know what we're going to do. We have the answers. But rather, the idea should be we're coming in support of local populations because they know. They are the experts of their own conflict. And so what we need to do is to support them rather than to direct them and to tell them what to do.
You keep coming back to this idea of having to have the knowledge of the local communities, which sounds very self-explanatory. And yet I take it from your writing that it is actually not there. Why do you think the United Nations spends so much money? It spends a lot of money on peacekeeping operations, and yet the knowledge of those specific conflicts, as you argue, is not present.
Well, the United Nations is predicated on the idea that they're a global organization. So they need generalists. They need people who know about gender, about human rights, about organization of elections. And then they can deploy these people to any conflict zone. So to Congo, to Syria, etc. And when you look at the career of people who work for the United Nations, they hop from conflict zone to conflict zones because they are hired for their what I call their thematic expertise, their expertise in gender, in elections, in human rights. And nobody really cares about what they know about the conflict, the country or the village in which they're going to work. It's seen as something that's secondary, that's not as important. What really matters for them is to have the expertise of gender, elections, etc., because that's what the UN values. And that, I think, is one of the things we absolutely need to change in the United Nations.
Well, I have to say that it's pretty shocking for me to hear that several decades after discussing how to improve the effectiveness of peacekeeping operations, that's still the case. But Professor Artesar, we have to take a very short break now. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Severin Artesar, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Professor Artesar, this more localized, more grassroots approach that you are advocating presumes that there's a genuine interest in ending all those conflicts. Can one really presume that in this day and age?
Well, for people who are victims of the conflict, who are living in the conflict zones, yes. The overall majority of the people I've met, whether again we're talking about people in Afghanistan, in Congo, in Israel and the Palestinian territories, I would say 99% of them tell me that they absolutely want peace. They want to have a way to send their children to school, to feed their family, to have a career without worrying whether tomorrow they're going to be killed, they're going to be tortured, they're going to be dead.
Well, Professor Artesar, I can fully attest to the fact that for most people in conflict zones, peace is the ultimate value, but that puts them at odds with many other war experts and politicians who publicly advocate for armed resistance as a way to attain democracy, dignity, or some foreign policy goal. It's a strange question to ask, but what makes you believe that peace should be held as the ultimate value, which I think is a premise in much of your writing?
No, I believe that peace is the ultimate value for me. What I believe is that people should be given the choice and that we shouldn't impose our choices. So what I mean is that there is a trade-off between peace and democracy, between peace and justice. Although politicians are always telling us, oh, we can have everything at the same time, we can have peace and democracy, blah, 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 in a post-conflict situation or in a war situation, that's not true. And so what I mean is that instead of telling people, well, you can have everything and then failing to deliver on, you know, everything, we should be very clear and say, okay, you can have peace, like some kind of peace, you can have some kind of democracy, you can have some kind of justice in the short term. But unfortunately, we cannot build everything at the same time. So someone has to make a choice. And in the current system, in the current international system, it's outsiders who make these decisions for people on the ground, for Syrians, for Congolese. And what I'm saying is that they should be the one deciding.
Now, I certainly bring my own set of biases and experiences to this conversation, but having reported on a number of Arab conflicts, I'm absolutely convinced that peace was never the first priority in either Syria or Libya, for that matter. Those conflicts were intentionally flamed from the outside, and local communities, there were some communities I personally reported on who tried to resist this violence, at the end were absolutely helpless to do that. Do you think these changes at a micro level could be meaningful without major changes on a macro, that is, geopolitical level?
Yes. Basically, what we need is we need both. What I've been saying so far is that if you don't have the changes on the micro level, if we don't build peace from the grassroots, then no matter what you do at the time, it's not going to work because people are always going to have reasons to fight. Let's say you and I are fighting over a piece of land. If our presidents make an agreement and then they decide they're at peace, you and I will still continue to fight over our piece of land. We don't care about what happens among elites. And by the same token, if you and I make a deal, our presidents won't care whether we've made a deal or not. So we really need to have both top-down and bottom-up peace so that we can have an end to this conflict that we've been talking about.
But if I may disagree with you a little bit, maybe in African conflicts, people are still fighting over resources and land and access to water. But in many of the Arab conflicts, they were fighting over the top position in the country. And changing a person who sits or who rules that country was a major objective of a number of foreign states. So, I can tell you my personal story. I reported on a Druze village in Syria, and they were very dedicated to making sure that this bloodshed that they saw around them does not affect them. But at the end, they failed because if a foreign militant group funded and trained abroad comes into your village, into your area, you're absolutely helpless in resisting it. This is what I mean. Don't you think that we ultimately have to change the way we relate to war and stop calling somebody else's terrorist another man's freedom fighter?
Yes, but what you're saying is, don't we have to work with elite? And I've been telling you from the start that yes, we do have to work with elite. We do have to work with presidents and rebel leaders because, as you say, they can jeopardize anything that we achieve on the ground. But what I'm saying is that it's not sufficient. Mm-hmm. It's not sufficient because we've seen over and over and over again that this kind of agreements between presidents and rebel leaders, or the fact of replacing one strong man with another strong man, it doesn't bring peace. Look at what happened in Afghanistan. We've replaced one president with another president, one regime with another regime. Do we see peace on the ground? No, we don't. So what I'm saying is that, yes, it's important to look at that, to look at these personalities, at these elite conflicts, but also we absolutely have to look at what ordinary people can do to build peace. Mm-hmm. And the other way is, like, I often get the question that you're asking me, being like, well, you know, if any elite, any president, any rebel groups can attack a village and then destroy their peace, then it doesn't matter whatever peace that they've been able to achieve for the past few weeks or the past few months or the past few years. And I'm like, well, if you live in a village, if you think about the human beings who lives in that village, the fact that they've been able to have some kind of peace, some kind of security for a few days, for a few weeks, for a few months, for a few years, it's so important. It actually makes a huge difference in their lives. And to me, that's what actually matters. It's not abstract piece of papers, it's whether people on the ground, ordinary people, are going to have a life that is a little bit better for at least a few more days or a few more years.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. For people who are on the ground, whose lives are being jeopardized, peace is always the ultimate priority. It is. It only becomes abstract when you talk about it in foreign capitals and think about your country's strategic interests. Anyway, you point out in your recent article that UN peacekeepers are the second largest military force deployed abroad after the U.S. military. And the Americans often portray their military presence in foreign lands as aimed at ensuring peace and stability. How is the U.N. experience at peace building and peacekeeping different from what the Americans attempted in both Afghanistan that you mentioned and Iraq?
Well, when the UN goes in, when the United Nations goes in, usually they are invited by all of the warring parties. And when they arrive on the ground, very often people have a good opinion of the United Nations, have a lot of very high expectations. The blue helmets, the soldiers of the United Nations, are viewed as a symbol of peace. And it's only with time that people see that their expectations are not being met, and then they start changing their views of United Nations peacekeepers. But for the first few years, usually there is this really, really, really high expectations, and United Nations peacekeepers, I remember when they arrived in Congo in 1999, they were so incredibly popular because everybody thought, oh yeah, the savior has arrived. Like, they're really, really here to help us. Mm-hmm. And now 20 years from now, they're seen as an occupying power, mm-hmm. as you know, pretty much another army. Mm-hmm. But from the start, the expectations, the attitudes, the way people relate to United Nations peacekeepers is completely different.
But when the Americans, for example, started their campaign in Iraq, we also saw on American television how ecstatic crowds were to greet them. Does it mean that the locals extend the same welcome to non-UN forces, in this case the American forces?
Well, it really depends. I think that it depends on the village that you're talking about. It depends on the communities. The kind of welcome that soldiers get, even now, United Nations peacekeepers still get a very warm welcome in some communities, and same for the U.S. soldiers in some villages in Iraq. So I think it's really hard to make this kind of blanket statement and to talk about the overall perception of United Nations peacekeepers or overall perception of United States soldiers. Mm-hmm. What matters to me is what they can do with these perceptions and how they can use these perceptions to actually build peace on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that the U.S. Army in Iraq and in Afghanistan really had as a primary goal to build peace, while for United Nations peacekeepers, it's in their mandate. It's absolutely their role to build mm-hmm. peace on the ground.
Now, I'm speaking to you from Moscow, so I have to ask you about Russia's recent forays into conflict resolution, particularly in Syria. And I think for now, it is using some of the UN methods. For example, it deploys its own military police, staffed primarily by Muslims, to do the work that the blue helmets normally do in other conflict zones. What are the potential pros and cons of individual countries trying on this peacekeeping mantle?
Well, whether we're talking about individual countries like Russia or big organizations like the United Nations, I think the fundamental problem is that we're relying on foreigners to actually do things that should better be done by local people. So, for instance, what can a Russian soldier or a French soldier, for that matter, or a Russian policeman or a French policeman, what can this person know about the conflicts that are dividing a Syrian village? Unless this person has a PhD in Syrian history, which I doubt many soldiers and policemen have, they don't know the ins and outs of the situations. So the idea of bringing outsiders to resolve conflict within a country, to me, it's flawed from the start. So again, we need to step back and we need to review these kind of approaches.
But the alternative to that would be sending the Syrian official police force into the same villages, and I suspect that that may be met with far greater fear and distrust on the part of the local population.
And that would be quite a disaster, and that's not what I think would be the best solution. The best solution is, okay, let me give you the example of an organization that I like very much. It's called the Life and Peace Institute, and its team in Congo have developed a way to help local people build peace. So they work in very, very divided villages where you have different armed groups, ethnic groups that are fighting, and they're all associated with different rebel leaders and president. So, you know, the kind of conflict that you see and you say, they're intractable, we can never do anything. And the way LPI in Congo works is that they go in and then they start talking with everybody, with all of the villagers, to try to understand what, from the villagers' point of view, what are the reasons for the fightings, what would be potential solutions, and what villagers need in terms of international support to implement these solutions. And then they help people implement those solutions. So what I'm saying is that it's a strategy that doesn't rely on an outside force like, you know, the Russian police or the Russian army or United Nations peacekeepers. It doesn't rely on the state or on the national army or on the national police, but it relies on local capacities, on supporting local capacities and putting people in the driver's seat, letting people decide how they want to handle their own conflict.
Well, Professor Atasar, let's hope we see more inspiring examples like this in 2019. But for the time being, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Our viewers can keep this conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR. CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.